Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Well, coming up, we'll learn about flying Trillium. It's a 100-acre living laboratory in Sullivan County full of native plants and wildlife. Environmentalist and landscape designer Carolyn Summers has been running it for 2 decades. Radio Catskill's Jamie Case will talk to her about the power of native plants. That's coming up in the second half of the program. But first, we've got the latest news from the Times, Union, Hudson Valley, including the latest housing news and how the Rhinebeck community is rallying to stop the deportation of one of its residents. We'll start with some big news in New York politics. The fact that we learned this week that Congressman Mike Lawler of the 17th District is now saying he will not be running for New York governor. I spoke to Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley, earlier today.
Whispers about this have been going around for a week or so. I think it was Politico Playbook may have reported last week that he was telling friends that he was actually not going to mount a campaign for governor next year on the Republican ticket. And he confirmed that himself yesterday, first in an interview with the New York Times and then on Fox and Friends. He's currently not speaking to the Times Union, so we haven't heard this directly from him, but it's been widely reported that he is instead going to seek re-election to his House seat in that very competitive 17th district in the lower Hudson Valley.
Politicians don't announce until they absolutely have to, and they're thinking of running for major office. There's a lot of politics involved in those decisions. But sometimes it's hard to tell when a candidate is being coy or cooling off altogether. And I kind of felt, I don't know how or why, but I kind of felt like Lawler was cooling off here the last week or two. But part of that also might be that, like, I'm looking at what he's saying about running for governor. At the same time, I'm reading about the big, beautiful bill that was passed and the impact that that's having on Medicaid. So I wonder, like, how much do issues like that and everything else that he's dealing with play into this decision?
It's hard to say. He hasn't elaborated too much on his thinking here. His statement was basically, after months of deliberating and really working through it, I've decided the right thing to do for me and my family and my district is to run for re-election. Now, to me, the most interesting part of that sentence is, and my district. There's been some reporting that President Trump had a closed-door meeting with House Republican leadership last week, stressing the need to do everything they can to try to maintain competitiveness in the House and not an outright majority in next year's midterm elections. As just about everybody knows, the district that Lawley represents is one of the most competitive in the country. It was like top five most spending of any of the races last year. And it was held by a Democrat, albeit with slightly different borders, for over a decade before Lawler narrowly won it in 2022. And then he expanded pretty substantively on that margin in 2024 last year against Mondaire Jones. I think the other thing at play here is that the other sort of
likely potential candidate.
Yeah, is Elise Stefanik. And Stefanik has been in Congress for longer than Lawler. She's a more higher-ranking member than him. And it seems quite likely, although she has also not announced whether or not she will run, it seems quite likely that she will enter the race. And so she both kind of outranks him in terms of seniority, and her House seat up in the North Country leans quite heavily Republican. And so that's one that the GOP would very likely not lose, even if their incumbent were not in the race next year.
Yeah, the polling that gets quoted here at the end of the article is interesting because, you know, it said basically that, like, Stefanik, you know, was doing much better than Lawler in a potential primary. but that, you know, basically in a hypothetical poll from Siena saying that if Lawler was a nominee going up against Hochul, a plurality of 44% of voters said they would choose Hochul. But when it was Stefanik offered as a nominee, support for Hochul jumped up 3% to 47%. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, to be honest, that dynamic is really interesting to me as well. I think it's really illustrative of the gap between how candidates have to run in a primary in our kind of increasingly divided political climate and how they have to run in a general election. You know, Republicans in New York have made gains over the past couple of years. You know, Lee Zeldin ran much closer than anybody thought against Kathy Hochul a couple of years ago. Trump just last year got, I think, the highest share of the vote of a Republican presidential candidate statewide in New York in several cycles. And Stefanik is obviously much more closely aligned ideologically and in terms of just her comportment with Trump than is Lawler. And that generally appeals to dyed-in-the-wool Republicans. However, you have to win a lot of Democrats to win a statewide election in New York, and Lawler has kind of positioned himself as a moderate, you know, one of the few remaining, certainly on the Republican side of the aisle in the House. And that gets him occasionally tarred and feathered with the Republican in name only, the RINO acronym, by Trump supporters and folks more on the hard right. But it does, as that polling indicates, put him, I believe, in a stronger position to win a statewide election, particularly against a fairly unpopular incumbent in Kathy Hochul.
Well, let's go now, because I know you're following a story about a Honduran immigrant who was arrested in Rhinebeck last week by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agents. What happened there?
Yeah, so this is a story that a lot of folks up in the Mid-Hudson Valley have been talking about. So last week, ICE officials in Rhinebeck arrested a 23-year-old man named Gerson Jose Santa Maria Tercios. He is a Honduran immigrant who has lived in this country for over a decade, I believe. Or not quite a decade, I guess, since it appears he crossed into this country in 2019. He graduated from Rhinebeck High School. He owns a local lawn care and landscaping business. He has no criminal record, at least that we're aware of. Yet he was swept up in this ICE action. And that's prompted a major outcry from locals there, many of whom knew him either because they went to school with him or their kids went to school with him, or in the case of one woman who was kind of leading the fundraising efforts, she employed him as a lawn care worker. And so there's been this major fundraising campaign that has attracted even the likes of celebrities like Paul Rudd, Rhinebeck's own. And an increasing amount of media attention as well. He was able to get a temporary restraining order that stayed his deportation for at least a week, and then he had a court hearing in federal court in Manhattan yesterday, where the judge essentially punted on a decision. She denied extending the temporary restraining order. But she said basically because she was acting in an emergency capacity, the people backing him could bring additional evidence, and the judge who oversees that court in a non-emergency hearing could then make a ruling on the merits of the case about whether or not to deport him. So the advocates backing him view this as a win because this is all happening super fast. This gives them, they say, you know, an extra week to get the lawyer that they've recently hired up to speed, to file additional motions, and to produce additional testimony. But the clock is ticking. you know, he was arrested, according to ICE, pursuant to a warrant of deportation. An ICE spokesperson told us that he admitted to unlawfully entering the United States through Texas without admission or parole to an immigration officer when he encountered him in December of 2019. That officer, who was a Border Patrol officer, issued him a notice to appear in immigration court, and that judge ordered his removal back in 2023. So it appears that's the only crime he's committed, was crossing into this country illegally.
Right. Where is Tercios now?
He is, according to online immigration records, he is still being held in custody at the Orange County Correctional Facility. That's pending removal and or pending any future court hearings.
We're talking with Phil Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley, and one of the things that we cover, ongoing stories overall here at Radio Catskill, is housing issues, but specifically with you, Philip, is the battles over housing in New York's more recent housing laws and the way that's been playing out in upstate New York, with the Hudson Valley kind of leading the way and being a leading indicator. Well, you have an interesting case that you're looking at in Kingston that might have some different implications than other landlord-tenant cases.
Yeah, so this was a decision, not really like a court ruling because it's not a court, but just a sort of a clarification that came out of the state's Office of Rent Administration yesterday about a privately held apartment complex in Kingston whose owners were trying to get it exempted from the city's rent stabilization. So this requires a little bit of background. I'll explain it as simply as I can. But basically, this apartment complex, which is called Stony Run, it was purchased in 2020 by a for-profit real estate investment firm called Acker Companies. The complex needed a lot of work, a lot of repairs and renovations, which they undertook, believing that they would be able to put nice new apartments on the market at market rate. While they were doing that, the city became the first in upstate New York to adopt the Emergency Tenant Protection Act, which is the rent stabilization law, which basically allows the city to form a board to set rent guidelines for protected buildings, which ended up including this one, Stony Run. So Stony Run they advocated against the rent stabilization before it happened. And then afterward, they told the mayor and the city council that, hey, we're going to end up losing a lot of money on this if we can't charge the rents that we thought we would be able to. And so they hammered out a deal with the mayor and the city council whereby they would form a kind of shell company, a nonprofit, transfer ownership of the building to that entity, and that entity would be exempted from rent stabilization. But under this law, basically any existing tenants would still be protected. They would only lose those rental protections once the apartment's turned over. Now, you probably don't need me to tell you that what's happened while that agreement was in place is that like about a quarter of the tenants at Stony Run have filed notices with the city or with the state, saying that they've been unlawfully evicted or that repairs aren't being done. Basically, this place is sort of notorious in Kingston for being quite poorly run, and the tenants and their advocates say that it's because the developers are trying to evict them so they can put the apartments back on the market at a market rate. So what happened this week was, or actually technically last week, although we only learned about it this week, was that the State Office of Rent Administration, both the city and the tenant advocates had asked it to decide whether or not this gambit to move the complex's ownership to this nonprofit shell company was legal. They said, no, it's not. They said there's basically no indication that the shell company is acting like a nonprofit. They said it's essentially transparent that this was just to try to exempt the building from rent stabilization, and that that was not allowed, and that the building will in fact be subject to rent stabilization. So the reason I think this is important is because, as far as I know, this is the first instance in which a building in one of these smaller Hudson Valley or anywhere upstate New York cities that would be subject to rent stabilization has attempted to try to get out from under that. And, you know, I do think that's important because, for one, the due to the specifics of the rent stabilization law, it only applies to, you know, anywhere between like a quarter and a third of rental units in most upstate cities. There is a law, or there is a bill in the state legislature that didn't get heard this year, but may next year, that would dramatically expand that. But nevertheless, you know, any ruling from the state that says, hey, you can't try this kind of maneuver to get out from rent stabilization, I think is worth noting and will probably be a cooling effect on anybody trying to do that in any other city.
Right. It might be a chilling effect, but at the same time, we've seen that especially landlords have been, you know, getting creative, looking for various ways to avoid some of these newer regulations. So this might put a chilling effect on that, but is it really, how hard and fast of a precedent could this possibly be? Because it seems like somebody could try this again if they wanted.
I could see a situation where maybe if a developer already had a nonprofit arm, if it transferred, right, you know, a rent stabilized building to that arm, maybe there would be a different kind of ruling. There's also the fact that, like, Kingston's rent stabilization was held up in court for like 3 years pending other lawsuits, which, you know, most of which I've talked about on this show,
right,
over the course of the years. And it's currently undergoing another rental vacancy survey to see if it still qualifies for rent stabilization. So all of this could be moot in a few months anyway. But yeah, you're right that developers and landlords will be creative. So we'll just have to see if anyone tries this exact playbook again, or if they make any tweaks to it.
Well, these stories that we talked about are up now at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Philip Pantuso, and we tend to do that on Thursday evenings here on the Local Edition. And I'm going to say, Philip, thank you so much once again for going over all this news with us.
You got it. Always good to be with you.
You're listening to the Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is the Local Edition, and I'm Jason Dole. It's time to talk about the power of native plants. Environmentalist and landscape designer Carolyn Summers shares insights from her 20-year project Flying Trillium. It's a 100-acre living laboratory in Sullivan County where native species and wildlife thrive side by side. It's a conversation about biodiversity, conservation, and what it means to truly care for the land. Here's Radio Catskill's Jamie Case.
I think if I were to ask you to envision a native species, your mind might not automatically go to a plant. But for today's guest, that's exactly where it goes. Carolyn Summers, can you define what a native plant is for our listeners?
Sure. So native plants have been here for eons, like millennia. This part of the United States, this part of North America was glaciated, right? We had glaciers. And the glaciers came in waves back and forth and back and forth. But the most recent glaciers left about 10,000 years ago. And slowly, the native plants from the south that had been pushed to the south came back and revegetated themselves. And those plants and the animals that lived with them have co-evolved, and they have important interactions between plants and animals that we're, you know, still learning more about. The difference between exotic plants and native plants and, of course, the invasive plants are harming the environment. They can harm it in several ways. They can harm it by simply displacing native plants. They can harm it by actively shading out and taking over aggressively land areas from native plants. And they can also harbor organisms, diseases, and fungus that harm our native plants.
So as I've read, Flying Trillium is a 100-acre, essentially, garden in Sullivan County. Can you describe to me the work that you guys are doing there?
What we do here is we give people tours of the gardens, and we educate people about the importance of native plants and why we plant native plants and how important the plants are to the overall ecosystem to support insects, pollinators in particular. That seems to be what a lot of people are very interested in. And my goal as a landscape designer has always been to create more habitat for other living creatures.
Also, I'm just curious, where does the name Flying Trillium actually come from?
That's a series of, that comes out of a series of photographs I took here in the preserve, showing that the trilliums were at this point in time limited to kind of hanging off the ravine cliffs because the deer had eaten so many of them. The ones that were really flourishing and still looking good were just sort of hanging in sort of off the cliffs, looking like they were kind of flying. When you see them from that angle, you only see two of the three leaves. And the flower itself looks like a little propeller, like an antique airplane. So that's where I got the name Flying Trillium from.
So I know also that you grew up in the Adirondacks, which is obviously a very environmentally lush area of New York. So what was it like to study the environment in a place like New York City?
The interesting thing about learning about native plants in New York City is that, you know, people are always surprised at that. Well, why weren't you, because most of the city at that time, of course, and still is landscaped with all kinds of crazy exotic plants. I guess maybe because they were sort of at the epicenter of the invasive species problem, New York City was rapidly transitioning to using more and more native plants, especially their parks department had a natural resources group. And even my landscape professors at CCNY were advocating native plants. Again, living in New York City, you're surrounded by invasive plants. And it becomes, once you start looking at the natural areas in New York City and nearby areas like Westchester County, you see that it's becoming overrun with plants that it becomes monocultural, and you can, and your eye can see that once you get attuned to that, you'll see. And it's very disturbing actually to see that how that landscape transitions from being an area where there's lots and lots of different kinds of plants to areas that are just consumed by vines and things like that.
So when you actually bought the plot of land, what was the first, ground broken? What was the first planting project that you guys kind of took on?
Well, what was interesting and sort of challenging at first is that I had mostly gardened in shade in Westchester County. One of the nice things about a lot of areas there is that there are large trees. My particular residence was very well shaded. In fact, I tried to grow tomatoes in the only place that I could, which was on a roof. And even on the roof, I didn't get enough sun to grow tomatoes. So I had to learn when we bought this place, which had been a series of actually a hay farm. So a series of hay fields, essentially, surrounded by some areas of older forest. We basically were in full sun. So I needed to plant a lot of trees and shrubs. And that's what I did, and create my own shade. But in the process, I learned more about meadows and restoring meadows and planting sun-loving plants. So it was that was part of my new education.
When you're choosing what to grow or what to preserve, what are the things that you consider? Is it just simply, nativity to the area, or are there other factors that you guys, kind of consider when you're keeping up this land?
One way to answer that question, I guess, is that you're always looking at the conditions of the land and what the land will support in terms of sun, shade, wet, dry, what the soils tell you about the site. And one of the really interesting things about this property is that it has many different types of soils and many different aspects in terms of sun versus shade. So we have a great wealth to choose from, and we can offer many different types of little ecotones here and there. There are areas where it's very sandy and open and sunny, and you would grow those types of plants in an area like that. And then we also have some very specific areas where I don't plant at all, but we do show parts of the preserve, like the bog, which is very interesting and unique. And it's not something that you would really necessarily want to plant into because it's kind of cool the way it is. And then there's areas out front in the front fields that are moist meadow areas that you might try to introduce plants that would like that kind of an area. And then around the house, our cabin is pretty well landscaped in a very traditional manner, except they're all native plants. So the land will kind of tell you what you need to plant. Having said that, though, there is a wide variety of plants that use all of those different areas. In New York State, we have very few plants that are just native to New York State. Most of our plants are native to other parts of the Mid-Atlantic and other parts even of the Midwest.
So you seem pretty passionate about the tours and the whole community aspect. Why do you find it important to have this kind of visual learning experience to the work that you guys do?
Well, because there aren't a lot of examples. If you go to almost any botanical garden, you're going to see everything under the sun from anywhere in the world. And a lot of gardens that are open to the public are gardened, heavily gardened with plants from around the world. A lot of our most typical garden plants, most of them are not native. I could go into a whole thing about the history of the landscape industry and explain some of that. But the fact is that we still garden largely the gardening public and the big ag, the nurseries part of big ag. They're all basically growing plants from someplace else. There's economic and cultural reasons for that, but it's not... the case that most people grow up learning about native plants or learning to garden with them. So there's been a need for this, and people have reacted very well to the idea of seeing large areas of native plants in the landscape as opposed to what you would normally see in any other kind of cultivated garden.
Other than upkeeping the Flying Trillium Gardens, I'm just kind of personally curious, is there any projects that you do that are kind of more personal or not for public consumption, or, just things that bring you joy?
The main thing I like to do now is photograph the butterflies and the caterpillars that are using the plants. So I especially love the caterpillars. They're really cool little organisms to identify and photograph. Some of them are quite beautiful, like little jewels. And maybe you've heard Doug Ptolemy talk about this. He's very famous now, writer about, he's an entomologist in Delaware, and he has written books about this, and his photographs and his YouTubes are, very well established. And I guess I sort of learned how beautiful they were from looking at his pictures. And I love to look for them here and photograph them. But basically any wildlife, I just love to photograph wildlife and the flowers, of course, themselves.
When are your upcoming open garden days, just for everybody listening?
Yeah, so we'll have open days on July 26th, August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, and the August 30th. I think that's it. But if people are interested, they can go to our website, which is Flying Trillium, www.flyingtrillium.com, and learn more about us.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jamie. Well, that's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. I want to thank you for being here with me. I'll be here again tomorrow night. Patricio Rubio will be your host. And listen tomorrow morning at 10 for more live news and local conversations on Radio Chatskill with Tim Bruno. For now, spread the word about this public radio station, if you please, and support whatever responsible media outlet you can. Share our links. Let folks know Radio Catskill is here. We're defunded. We're not defeated. We're reporting. We're not reposing. We're speaking out. We're not shutting up. Go to WJFFradio.org to stand with us. WJFFradio.org. Also, find us, like us, subscribe, whatever you got to do. Radio Catskill on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. Follow our social media. Spread the word. That's what you heard. Local news, culture, and NPR. Here on Radio Catskill. Daily's up next.